A new report finds that by 2050, a large portion of the U.S. will have at least one day per year where the heat index reaches 125 degrees Fahrenheit. Even more Americans would have multiple days in a row of 100 degrees or more, including parts of Wisconsin. Extreme heat can be one of the most lethal natural disasters. Our next guest has studied the impact of heat waves on communities, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. We're already seeing some of this in different parts of the world. Have you been affected by a heat wave in recent years here in Wisconsin, or if you were in another part of the world at the time? Do you have questions about heat waves as a natural disaster? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Richard Keller is a professor in the Department of Medical History and Bioethics at UW-Madison. He's the author of the book Fatal Isolation, which looked at the effects of the Paris heat wave of 2003. Richard, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, according to this study, in a few decades, a lot of the country would have at least one day with this heat index of 125 degrees Fahrenheit, classified by the National Weather Service as an extreme danger level. This is a type of heat most of us aren't used to or used to functioning with. Can you talk about the hazards of a temperature like that?
Sure. Those hazards are really correlated with the kinds of activity you're engaged in. So if you're sitting around, sitting in the shade and so on, it's probably not all that dangerous. But once you start engaging in any kind of activity at all, then those heat indices above 125 degrees pose extreme risk of heat stroke, of dehydration, heart failure, kidney failure, a broad range of afflictions.
Now, heat waves aren't, I think, the most thought about disaster out there. We think of hurricanes and earthquakes, but heat waves tend to be the most lethal disasters. They cause more fatalities than all of those other natural disasters, as I understand it. Can you talk about the kind of impact a heat wave can have?
Absolutely. If we look at extremely dangerous heat waves, which are increasing, right? They're increasing in intensity, in duration, and in frequency over the past 20 years. They are, in the United States, the most dangerous form of extreme weather. They're actually more dangerous than all other forms of extreme weather combined in terms of the numbers of deaths they cause. So they have this profound impact on mortality levels, but it's also an uneven impact. The people who are affected tend to be on the low end of the socioeconomic scale. They tend to be older. They tend to have higher rates of disability, and they tend to be more socially isolated than others who are at less risk.
Can you talk about the kinds of heat problems we're experiencing around the world? We've seen news stories out of England this year, the Pacific Northwest of the United States. As you mentioned, these problems, we're seeing them more often.
We're seeing them far more often, and we're seeing them in places where one doesn't necessarily expect extreme heat to strike. So the Pacific Northwest, for example, historically has been quite cool and had quite pleasant summers. Indeed, this is part of the reason why the extreme heat is so dangerous there, because most houses, most apartments don't have air conditioning. So that just really exacerbates the pressure that extreme heat puts on a population. Likewise, in the UK, it's a place that has cool, pleasant summers typically. But increasingly, we're seeing dangerous heat striking in Northern Europe. We're also starting to see extreme heat playing a critical role in places that historically have been used to it. So we're seeing extremely dangerous heat waves striking in places like Phoenix, Arizona, where they're, of course, not unused to temperatures above 115 degrees or so. And what's happening in these places is not so much the increase in temperature itself, but the increase in the population at risk, an increase in a vulnerable population. For example, low-income workers who don't have access to air-conditioned apartments or houses.
This report I mentioned, it's from the organization First Street Foundation. It literally looked all over the United States. As you look at this report and other information, what kind of things do you worry about here in Wisconsin specifically?
It's interesting because there could be some possible upsides to what's happening with the climate in Wisconsin, at least temporarily. One thing we might see, for example, is a longer growing season. We might also see population growth in the state as we see an increase in property values and people moving here, trying to escape those extreme temperatures in other parts of the country. But that said, we'll also see increased flood risk, increased risk of mold as our basements flood more often. Will that longer growing season for some crops also, of course, means a longer mosquito and tick season, which brings with it, of course, a higher risk of mosquito or tick-borne disease. We won't see the same kinds of extreme temperatures as in, for example, Texas or Florida or other parts of the country, but that also doesn't necessarily mean that we're out of the woods here.
Talking to Richard Keller from UW-Madison, looking at predictions of a greater likelihood of extreme heat events in the years to come around the country, around the world. You can join in with your reactions or your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Richard, a tricky thing when we talk about climate change is that we talk about global average temperatures going up a degree Celsius, 2 degrees Celsius, which doesn't sound so bad. But can you talk about the chances of more extreme heat variation, especially high heat variation, that comes along with that increasing average?
Sure. This is where I think looking at what exactly the heat index provides good insight into why these little differences can really matter. So heat index is a combination of relative humidity with temperature. And it's important to note that rising heat indexes are nonlinear. So for example, if it's 80 degrees outside and the relative humidity is 95%, it's going to feel like it's 86 degrees outside. But if it's 90 degrees outside and the humidity is 95%, it's going to feel like it's 127. So those little differences can be really significant. So for example, if you look at these extremely dangerous temperatures where you have a heat index above 125, well, if it's 92 degrees out, it needs to be 85% humidity to constitute that extremely dangerous heat index. But if it's 96 degrees, just 4 degrees warmer, that relative humidity only needs to be 70% to make for extremely dangerous temperatures. So that's where, if we see an increased temperature of just a few degrees, we're going to see many more days with those extreme, that put us in the extreme danger zone.
How important is the duration of a heat wave? One day, maybe not so bad. String 2 or 3 days together, it starts to get worse.
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely correct. Duration is absolutely critical. Our bodies are extremely resilient. So if we're suffering through a 110 degree day, something along those lines, just a couple of hours of cooler temperatures can really make all the difference between literally life and death. But if you start adding up day after day where the temperature is over 100 degrees and the heat index is over 110, 115, then it really starts to add up and really starts to deplete the body. And the risk of heat stroke grows just exponentially with every day, every successive day of that heat wave.
Now, heat waves are a natural disaster in some ways. I've seen the argument that they're also a social disaster. And I think the title of your book, Fatal Isolation, gives a hint at that. Can you talk about the social conditions that can make a heat wave even worse?
Sure, absolutely. As I indicated earlier, socioeconomic status is absolutely critical. The poor are at far higher risk of dying during a heat wave than the rich. That has to do with things like creature comforts to some extent. If you're poor, you're less likely to have air conditioning than if you're rich. You're also likelier to have to work than if you're rich, right? So if it's an extremely hot day, if you have resources, you are probably working in an air-conditioned environment, but there's a higher likelihood of working in manual labor for poorer populations to some extent. So the people who are at really serious risk of heat stroke as a function of labor are people who are engaged in paving, roofing, a broad range of outdoor activities where there's just absolutely no respite from the heat. Also, as we age into risk. So older populations tend to be physiologically more vulnerable to heat stroke and dehydration, but they're also socially more vulnerable. The critical factor in preventing death from heat stroke or death from dehydration during a heat wave is social integration. These are preventable deaths. If someone brings you a cool bottle of water, if someone is there to call an ambulance, if you collapse, that dramatically reduces your risk of dying. But as we age, we tend to age out of our social networks. As our friends and relatives die around us or go into retirement homes and simply aren't available to us in quite the same way. So that social isolation as a function of things like aging, as a thing of things like disability, poor mental health status, all of those factors really add up to create major social vulnerabilities.
We're talking about the extreme heat predicted for the coming decades with Richard Keller, professor in the Department of Medical History and Bioethics at UW-Madison, author of the book Fatal Isolation about the Paris heat wave of 2003. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have concerns about the risk of higher heat events? I'll throw in flooding and drought along the way over the next few decades. Are you hopeful that there could be changes made to reverse or at least limit the impact of climate change? Have you been through, in some part of the world, a major heat wave yourself? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A new report finds extreme heat, consecutive 100-degree days, is expected to become a more common experience for Americans by 2050. Richard Keller is with us, professor in the Department of Medical History and Bioethics at UW-Madison, author of the book Fatal Isolation about the Paris heat wave of 2003. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your concerns maybe about the risk of higher heat events here in the United States. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Mike joins us now in Jackson. Mike, hi.
Hi. So as a mail carrier, so I'm outside all day long. I see planes spraying in our skies, and I hear that it's called geoengineering, and I'm wondering if that has anything to do with this increased heat that we're seeing.
Mike, thanks for the call. There are conspiracy theories about airplane emissions, but one thing that's not a conspiracy theory is airplane emissions are climate change emissions. Richard, one thing I wanted to bring up kind of related to that is some climate researchers have looked at this report and said, you know, these are, assuming we don't do anything, we don't mitigate climate change along the way. Do you look at some of the actions, including the recently passed bill in Congress, and think maybe some of these worst heat events could be averted?
I think perhaps some of the worst heat events could be averted, but this is a fairly conservative bill that just passed. It's not likely to have a really significant impact. It certainly isn't likely to reverse the climate that is already in the midst of changing. At best, it will perhaps slow the onset. And so maybe we won't see these temperatures in 2053, as the report says, but maybe we'll have to wait till 2063 to see them. But indeed, it seems as if mitigation is something it's almost too late for. What we really need to do is prepare for this changing climate and think about how we can reduce social vulnerability as well as physical vulnerability.
And Richard, I wanted to ask about that kind of preparation from your work looking at this 2003 heat wave in Paris. What kind of things can communities, especially those maybe not currently used to big heat waves, do to prepare?
Sure. Well, the Paris situation was somewhat anomalous, but unfortunately is something that's going to become increasingly more common as our climate changes. In Paris in 2003, in August, they experienced 2 weeks of temperatures at or above 100 degrees, quite high humidity, virtually no breeze because of the kind of weather system that just sort of locked itself in place over much of the country, not just the city, but also in Paris itself, really extreme social vulnerability. It coincided with a traditional August vacation period, so most people with resources had left the city. Lots of physicians were gone, lots of nursing staff were gone. Hospitals and government ministries were just completely overwhelmed by this disaster as the bodies started to pile up. And in Paris itself, they experienced about 1,000 deaths more than they would typically would expect in this period. In the country, in just about 2 weeks, they experienced 15,000 extra deaths. Those deaths are all attributable to this extreme heat. So what kinds of things can we do to prepare and avoid a disaster like that from happening here or elsewhere? It's interesting to see what France has done in the aftermath of that disaster. All new construction now has to have either solar panels on the roof or it has to have a green roof. So that would be where you have plantings on the roof. And that can actually change the temperature inside the building quite significantly. There have been real moves toward climate sustainability in French cities as a consequence of this heat wave. So now, for example, much of central Paris is off limits to cars. There's a new legislation, I think it goes into effect in 2030, where cars that burn gasoline are going to be banned from the city. Only electric cars will be allowed. So there's a range of things that we can do and that we've seen countries that have been profoundly affected by heat waves start to implement. These are the kinds of things we can do to perhaps offset the worst aspects of climate change, but also things we can do to try to lower those temperatures at really a kind of microclimate level to enhance our social vulnerability.
Yeah, can you talk?
Enhance our social resilience.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. Can you talk more about that microclimate concept? Because I've seen this more and more. You know, you look at the temperature in the news and think it's that for the whole region. It can really vary dramatically from block to block in some cases, depending on shade and construction and things like that. Can you talk about that a little?
Absolutely. Ground cover is absolutely critical, right? Land use is absolutely critical. So the temperature in a city, if you've ever been in a city on a hot summer day, is going to be much hotter than it is in the surrounding countryside or in a surrounding suburb. Even within a city itself, if you have a kind of leafy park with lots of trees and lots of green space, that's going to be significantly cooler, sometimes 5 degrees Fahrenheit cooler than those kind of hardscaped zones in the city with impervious surfaces, where you've got all this glass and asphalt and steel and concrete. And so those microscopic changes can make a real difference.
We're talking to Richard Keller, professor in the Department of Medical History and Bioethics at UW-Madison, author of the book Fatal Isolation, about the Paris heat wave of 2003, looking at, according to a couple new reports, the increased risk of extreme heat events in the United States over the next few decades. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234 with Mark in Milwaukee. Mark, hi.
Hey, so Rob, these temperature changes, I don't think we're going to have till 2050 before they really hit us. Because it's not able to, like, these models don't take into consideration things what they call feedback loops, where it's like if you have a whole lot of forest fires burning massive swaths of forest across the United States, you have the undersea conveyor where the ice is melting off of the glaciers, creating the jet stream and whatever else. And as some of these feedback loops kick in, it's going to spike and it's going to go, I think, a lot faster than people are prepared for. And I promise you this, the Earth is going to come back into balance one way or another, and whether we're here or not is yet to be seen.
Mark, thanks for the call. Richard, Mark making the case that we shouldn't be thinking about like we have 30 years to deal with this.
I agree. I think this is, it's an excellent point, and especially for the most vulnerable parts of the country. If you look at this study, it looks like much of the state of Florida is going to be virtually uninhabitable in 30 years. And indeed, this could happen much sooner.
Thanks for that call, Mark, at 800-642-1234. Do you feel, we've been talking about climate change at least since the 70s. Do you feel that as we see new reports like this showing more and more of the risks of the future, the events we're seeing today, do you feel that there's a sense of urgency to get ready for the risk of high heat, Richard?
Perhaps in some circles, but one of the most depressing things I've seen has been the sort of minimization of this study, the kind of trivialization of this study. I've seen on social media when people post links to the study, lots of replies, oh, guess what? Summer is hot. Those sorts of things where people just kind of dismiss it. I think what we really need to do is increase awareness of the real dangers posed by extreme heat. If you think about the kinds of depictions you see on television news when we see a heat wave, they typically show pictures of, you know, kids frolicking in fountains in big cities and things like that. That actually looks kind of fun. If they showed, bodies piling up at makeshift morgues, that might create a different kind of awareness and a different kind of sensitivity around extreme heat, where we wouldn't be so quick to dismiss it as just, you know, an extreme version of what summer already is, as opposed to the real health danger that it poses.
Is part of the problem the invisibility of this? I think back to I don't remember what year, in the 90s, the Chicago heat wave. A lot of people died, but they died in their homes. We just don't see the impacts directly.
Sure, heat waves certainly don't have the kind of visual impact of something like a hurricane or a flood or a tornado, of course. They tend to be like sort of neutron bombs where they kill people but leave infrastructure relatively intact. In Portugal, interestingly enough, the weather service there is coming up with a scheme to start naming heat waves in much the same way as we name tropical storms or hurricanes, as a means of generating higher awareness of those dangers. I think that that might be a move that could increase the visibility of extreme heat as posing such severe danger.
Richard, just in our last minute or so, what would you suggest if somebody, say, from a city government came to you and said, hey, what should we do to try to heat wave proof? Just briefly, what thoughts would you share with them?
I would say whatever one can do to overcome those barriers of social isolation, trying to develop networks at a neighborhood or even block level where we can check in on our vulnerable neighbors, providing incentives for people to check in on their older neighbors or neighbors who might be disabled and less able to get out of their houses, less able to get into a green space or to get to a cooling center. Really, having cooling centers open is great. But getting people there, think about homeless people who may not have access to transportation in quite the same way. All of these things are barriers that can really dramatically exacerbate vulnerability. And they're the kinds of things that I think we need to try to improve in order to mitigate that risk.
Richard, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
Richard Keller is a professor in the Department of Medical History and Bioethics at the UW-Madison. His book, Fatal Isolation, looked at the effects of the Paris heat wave of 2003. We're looking at new reports predicting more extreme heat in the years to come.